examples. Well, good way. And they just talk to it. Then in that process, they just tell us
from the beginning why you would want us to consider you to be among the 12. And before you do that, Prof, I hear some phones making some noise, so those who still have their phones, please, mic is next to me, making a bit of noise, they should switch them off. We prefer to keep the door shut at the back. Those who go in and out, as you go out, please close the door. Chileka, please come in. Or close. I think we should just give over to you now.
Well, let me kick off by thanking you. It's a real honor to be shortlisted for this board position. So let me thank all the portfolio committee and all of the people who have been involved in this process for considering me worthy of this honor. Let me make 2 points by way of introduction. The first is, if you look at my CV, you will see that I've really been involved in two worlds. The first world has been what I call the world of ideas. For the last 15, 20 years, I've been an academic at a variety of institutions. I've played a significant role as a researcher. And I've been researching issues of contemporary South African politics and development. That's what my lifeblood is. And effectively, I've been involved in that institution of writing. You will notice also that I have not been confined to writing in the academic terrain. While I think that's very, very important, I've always felt that there's an important need for a conversation to be happening between the academy and the broader public. So I've paid some attention in all my life to translating and transmitting the ideas that I develop in the academy into the broader public domain. So I'm a public commentator of some note. I engage in radio, I engage in television, I engage in a whole range of other forms of media. So that's the first world I operate in. The second world that I've always operated in is the world of institutional building. If you go back right from my early days as a young junior lecturer at the University of Durban-Wessel, I've always been involved in fundamental transformation questions. Initially, I was the general secretary of the academic union at the University of Durban-Wessel. Subsequently, I became one of the strategic planners at the University of Durban-Wessel on transforming the institution. Thereafter, I moved on to becoming the founding director of the Center for Civil Society. After that, I've been the executive director of the Human Sciences Research Council. And from next week onwards, I'm going to be the deputy vice chancellor of the University of Johannesburg. And in all of those roles, what I've been really focused on is trying to build institutions. And in a way, build institutions so that they become an enabling, they enable people to engage in the battle of ideas. So not only do I engage in the battle of ideas, I build institutions so that people feel enabled to engage in the battle of ideas. And it seems to me that that's, if you like, the single defining feature of my professional life over the last 17, 18 years. That's the first point I'd like to make. It seems to me that the second point I'd like to make, and I'd like to make it right from the outset, whatever limited experience I have in building public institutions, it's this, and it's a principal lesson. And that is that you cannot think about building a public institution that is neutral. Neutrality is false in any society, and it's particularly false in a society like ours. What you should be thinking about when you're building a public institution is not a neutral institution, but an institution that reflects a plurality of views, a plurality of ideas, because it is precisely a plurality of ideas that is crucial both to democracy and development. Development anywhere in the world is never a product of clever technocrats at the top. They never have sufficient information on the table. It has to be a product of contestation, of alternative viewpoints, engaging each other. What I often use, if you like, in a kind of corny expression, academic expression, development is the product of the contestation of empowered stakeholders. There is a multiplicity of stakeholders with a variety of views that engage each other. And in that, they achieve the balance that needs to be struck for a truly developmental agenda. And so for me, whether it's the SABC, whether you're looking at the University of Johannesburg, whether you're looking at the SFRC, you're not looking at a neutral institution. I've never been neutral in my life. I'm a profoundly political being. What I try to create, rather than neutrality, is a public institution that reflects a multiplicity of views. And it seems to me that that's the second defining feature of my resume over the last, in my professional life over the last 17 years.
So thank you very much. When you're done, you just switch it off. Thank you very much. I take it that is your trust, that's your intention why you want to go to the SABC to try and strengthen that institution.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly what I would do, what role I could play, if any. And ultimately, I think it's also true that I think the SABC as a public institution is not very different from other public institutions. It needs to reflect that multiplicity of views if it's going to have a significant effect on both its own mandate, but also the mandate of development and democracy in our society.
I'm not seeing any takers at the moment.
There they're coming.
Good. Let them stretch, and after that I'll check who's raising their hand. Prof, if you could to just give your own impression of the SABC now as a public broadcaster or a public service broadcaster, what would be your snapshot of it?
Well, my snapshot is that actually it's an interesting place. It's an institution that seems to be going through very much the kinds of birth pangs that many public institutions in South African society can. I think there's some, and I think often this is forgotten in the public domain, that there's been some great success stories at the SABC over the last couple of years. I mean, the SABC has played quite a significant role, for instance, in advancing a new cadre of journalists in our country. A lot of the people that have, the press has said a number of people have left the SABC and moved on to CNBC, etc. And that's very true. But it is interesting that it was the SABC that trained them, that first gave them the profile to emerge and to perform. So I think the SABC has performed a fantastic role at the level of generating a new cadre of journalists. I think the SABC has... there's been a significant change. If you simply looked before 1994 and now at the SABC, you look at a different type of programs. You're looking at multiplicity of languages. You're looking at a far higher level of local production. I think there's fantastic advances that is often made, that's often forgotten at the SABC. However, I also think that the SABC is struggling at this point. And it's struggling for a number of reasons. It's got really a bad rap at public relations level. I think over the last 12, 18 months, 2 years even, it's gone from one public relations crisis to another. Part of that has to do with the documentary around the president. Part of that had to do with the scandal around the blacklisting of commentators. Part of that had to do with the way it was managed and the inquiry that was instituted and how the recommendations were not followed. There's a whole series of public relations there. And it's very hard to say in entirety the complete extent of the crisis at the SABC, because one has to be an internal player to do that. But it seems to me that the fact that there is a perception there of important stakeholders that SABC is not reflecting a variety of views, that it's carrying a political line, I think should be a worry, even if it's only a perception. I have a particular relationship with journalists, because in my world, I often get interviewed by them, they often approach me, and I do know a number of them have left. I do know a number of them do not feel enabled. And that is sad, because you can only truly make the public fulfill your public mandate. You can only truly contribute to democracy and development, if you like, if the cadre that is located in the public institution feel empowered to undertake their tasks. And there are some in there who don't. My personal conversations with a number of them have indicated that they feel disempowered. And that is a worry. So whether there is a rational reason for them feeling like that, or whether it's simply a perception. The mere fact that there is that perception should be a worry to the management of the SABC and to the public authorities, to the board, and then ultimately to all of us. And therefore, I think it is a troubled institution that needs some kind of engagement. And that's something that if I can assist in, I'm more than willing to do so.
Thanks, Prof. I've seen Ms. Smuts, Mr. Peterson, Ms. Foss, and we'll take other hands. Ms. Smuts, should I... Are you sure?
Yeah,
okay. Are you sure?
When you refer to the concentration of ideas, which in other jurisdictions are called the marketplace of ideas, I heard a new version of that yesterday from our chairman. In the Communist Party, they speak apparently of the Festival of Ideas. Excellent, excellent. Gives it a celebratory aspect. And when you say that you believe in the contestation of ideas, then you are, of course, directly in line with the broadcasting laws, as it happens, also the constitution of the land, but the broadcasting laws specifically enjoin the public broadcaster to reflect a plurality of views and a variety of news. So that is what we want our public broadcaster to do. I think you've been a little bit kind to the institution in referring to the bad luck at the public relations level, although it is true that the print media regurgitate certain factoids, which are interpretations of certain events which have already been disproved, but and yet they keep resurfacing. It really worries me. The booing of the deputy president is one example, and so forth. So you've been kind to them, but and you've conceded a little bit that there's a problem of disempowerment among staff, but of course there's a serious problem. And I rely for evidence of that on Zulaki Sisuda and Gilbert Marcus's report. And you know, what seems to me the wickedest of all the things that have happened now over the last few deteriorating years is that editorial staff clearly no longer have the self-confidence to engage precisely in that contestation of ideas. So what I like so much about the way you've introduced your candidature is that clearly you have experience in the idea of building institutions which are devoted to thought and to the festival of ideas, and therefore you seem to me very well qualified to create the atmosphere in which the editorial staff will be allowed to do their thing. And the board, after all, is not there to be involved in that aspect, but it must be there as the guarantor of what is essentially media freedom. And I thought I would just like to ask you this one thing. I've heard you often on radio discussion shows with enormous interest, and you are particularly interesting on the succession battle, for example. Now, let's use that as an example where the plurality of ideas must be at play. If you were on the SABC board now, what kind of broad philosophical guidelines would you give to the management which is in charge of news and current affairs? How would you give them confidence or an idea of how you deal fairly with the succession battle that is going on now? And you know, I suppose even after Polokwane, it won't be over. I mean, these forces will still be at work in our society. What would you do as a board member to establish the kind of atmosphere in which people could deal with this?
Well, let me address this by two levels. Firstly, what I think, at the slightly abstract level, what I think is the role of a board in any organization, particularly in a public institution, and then I will speak particularly to that question. I have had a fair degree of experience having sat on boards, councils, probably two universities, a number of NGOs, and mainly in public institutions. And some of those have been traumatic experiences, and some of those have been very successful experiences. And, you know, the wisest words I've heard about the role of a board came from James Hurwell, who is the chair of the HSRC board, and which I have every now and then am invited to, as an ex-official member, I sometimes join. And I think a year or two ago, Jake, in a conversation with a number of us, said that the role of a board is to have a slight but influential touch. And I thought it's an accurate description of what is the role of a board. You have a slight, but it must be an influential touch. If you have more than a slight touch, then you're entering the world of the executive management. And why pay them the kinds of money you're paying them if you are going to actually engage in this thing? You actually mess up the place. I've seen that at a number of institutions where the board entered into micromanagement and destroys the place. So it needs to be a slight. But if it's not an influential touch, then what's the purpose of having the board ultimately? If you're going to be simply a conduit for the executive management, then there's no purpose in that. So you have a slight and influential touch. And it seems to me that what you need to do is speak about generic principles. Say these are broadly the objectives we define for this public institution. We would like you to develop a strategic plan to achieve those goals. But more fundamentally, we want indicators by which we measure you against. Now, any public institution has to have three or four things. For some of the institutions I had, the first thing you need to do is to be financially sustainable. Because you can have the most wonderful mandate, but if you're not financially sustainable, you close down in 3 or 4 years' time. Secondly, what's the purpose of being financially sustainable if you fundamentally erode your mandate? So your mandate has to be fulfilled. And in this case, it seems to me, your mandate is to provide, for the SABC, is to provide, if you like, a festival of ideas, a plurality of ideas that inform the broader public and contribute to the upliftment of the public discourse. But it also requires, in my view, to provide an entertaining set of programming that people find attractive, because otherwise they're going to tune off this thing. And then thirdly, it's like any public institution or society, is to be representative of a population. Now often, there's a huge tension between these imperatives. But it's not impossible to achieve. I've headed the democracy and governance program at the HSRC, and we're financially sustainable, and we've achieved a surplus in 3 years in this program. We are the most productive, and we are the most demographically representative political science team in the country. And I challenge anybody to it's possible to do. And so for me, the issue is not to start delving into the details of it. It's to actually say, this is what we expect to happen. We expect a plurality of views. Now, what are the indicators by which we're seeing that? We want to see a variety of coverage for a variety of parties. We want to ensure that there's a variety of consultants that are utilized. We don't want to see a single face appearing, whether it's Adam Habib or anybody else, appearing constantly in every single program. We want actual debates taking place that contributes to this thing. But even in public institutions, choices have to be made. And when those choices are made, one of the things, if I were to be on this board, I would argue, if choices have to be made, then choices need to be prioritized to raise the voices of poor and marginalized communities. And the reason is a very simple one, not because of a moral reason, although I think that is important, is because other empowered stakeholders have other avenues. If you go through the commercial press, their voices of business communities, etc., are articulated there. The one stakeholder that does get marginalized from a variety of institutions and mechanisms is poor and marginalized communities in whatever form. So if there is a need to prioritize, it seems to me that that's where the prioritization takes place. Now let me come to your example of the succession question. In the succession question, I'll tell you what I've done at the Democracy and Governance Program, because this is a politics program. It's a controversial program, by any means. And one of our big ideas is that actually, if there's a major contestation around the leadership of the ruling party in this country, then this is something that the Democracy and Governance Program should be involved in. I've got 26 members of staff, all of them are involved in this debate. On any one period, you will see all of them in radios and televisions and writing op-ed pieces. And all of them have very, very different views on this matter. Some believe that the succession issue, some actually believe in one or other candidate. Some articulate a much more historical view that I, for instance, have argued that you can't understand the succession question without understanding choices made around the macroeconomic policies of 1994 and 1995, that actually there's a historical overview that one has to look at. Some have looked at other mechanisms around this. So there's multiplicity of views around this. One of the few things that I do ask of all my team members is we are researchers. We are analysts. So analyze. Don't stand up and say, I support Thabo Mbeki or I support Jacob Zuma. You can conclude with that. But analyze why you do so, because that's the purpose. That elevates the public discourse. And for me, if you ask me what should be happening around the succession question, absolutely cover it. Absolutely have a multiplicity of views on the subject. Absolutely reflect the plurality of commentators on the issue. But also, elevate the debate. Elevate the debate beyond personalities. Elevate the debate to understand the developmental consequences, the institutional logics, the historical overviews around this. And it seems to me, whether we're looking at the Sunday Times, or Business Day, or ETV, there's a lack of that significant analytical engagement around the big political and developmental questions of our day. And in partly, it's got to do with the nature of programming. You know, we've got this peculiar thing, every talk show you see, whether on ETV or SABC and everything, they have five people in a half an hour. Well, that gives each one of those people 3 minutes to speak. That's impossible to interrogate. Some of the best programming elsewhere in the world, Hard Talk in BBC, whether you agree with them or not, Larry King Live, whether you agree with him or not, is the issue is you have one person on the opposite side, and a true interrogation of that. The only time I see that happening is with the president on particular interviews that have happened over the last 2 or 3 years. But other than that, it's the nature of our program. It's the structure of the programming itself. So I know I have a tendency to talk too much, so Chair, please feel free to say shut up. But that, for me, where I think the big questions lie. It's hard to elevate them. I will say one final thing. Anybody who says to me, you cannot mix the balance of financial imperatives, have a sustainable organization, a contestable and engaged environment where plurality of views are reflected. In our context, is talking nonsense. Because I've done it. And I think the HSRC has done it in a multiplicity of ways. And I think it's possible to do.
Prof, I must just share this one with you. You are the third nominee that is getting this type of response.
Oh, okay.
From the DA know-how.
Oh, okay.
No, the same. Thanks, Prof. Let me take Peter.
Yeah, thanks, Prof. And when you do get that kind of clap and support, then you're in trouble. So when it gets hot there, your own fault. Prof, this plurality of ideas that you're talking about, it seems that the broadcast, the public broadcaster, are in a rut because of the old order where that kind of ideas were not necessarily allowed. It seems to be impossible then to get out of that and start to deal with what you are suggesting that should happen. Hence one could speculate that's why you will find certain programs not being aired, the blacklisting, and a whole host of things. People feel disempowered, some of the journalists feel disempowered, and it's all of that. Now, what one must also notice is that every time you have a new board, it's actually as a start-stop. It's like there's not a continuation. It's not like a 2020 idea that was established that said, by 2020, that's where we want to be as a public broadcaster. And whoever becomes forms part of the board will strive to achieve that. Every time there's a new board and it's new top management, then everybody starts all over again, start reinventing the wheel. And that's why we can't continue with that. One direct question would be, the role of the public broadcast, should it be reflecting what society is today? Or what we aspire society to be. Because we seem to be reflecting what society is today. Very little, if at all, of what we aspire as a country to be. Okay.
Let me start by again saying that actually I think the the history of the SABC is an interesting institution, that it was, under the apartheid period, it was really a mouthpiece of the apartheid regime for a large period of time. I think towards the last few years of the transition, you began to see some plurality of discourse emerging in the SABC, but I can recall the height of the state of emergency, for instance. This is a really a dangerous place. In the post-1994 period, and this is why I think it's important to note, it hasn't been an entire story of doom and gloom. You know, I've actually participated in a series of programs on SABC, from Interface to SAFM. And I must say, I've never felt constrained in the times that I was there. That there were periods where it seems to me discourse flowered in the SABC. And then in other periods, it was constrained. When I've done Interface a couple of times with Nikiwe, I've done SAFM a couple of times with John Perlman, I've done SAFM recently with some of the new guys. In all of those contexts, I never felt constrained. But I do think that we are, if you ask me, we've been at a lower point now than we've been 3 years ago. And that's something that we need to think about. Why did that happen? What changed between 2002 and 2003 and 2007? Why is it in 2003 there was a flowering of discourse in a variety of ways, and it hasn't happened in this in 2007? So it's not a line like this. It's been like this, and that's something that's worth bearing in mind. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that it seems to me, to address your question, however, you've got to strike a balance. You know, I mean, I remember this years ago, I laughed and scoffed at it as a young kid. But my grandfather used to say to me, the essence of life is balance. You don't strike balance in anything, you get into trouble. And that's the thing about financial imperatives, public mandate, representativity. It's about striking the balance. And on the question of whether we reflect our society today, or whether we reflect the future, it's a question of balance. The thing that is the united, that unites us and should be uniting us, both as citizens, but also as a public broadcaster, despite all of our diversity of views, is the values of the Constitution. That's what should be uniting us. And the purpose of a public listing. And it seems to me that we need to speak in our programming, in our news, in the way we construct ourselves, both on what we are today, because otherwise you're completely divorced from any sense of reality, but also what you want to inspire to be. You want to be a society that is not only demographically representative, that is an equitable society that reflects a multiplicity of views, and fundamentally that is that represents a cosmopolitan nationalism. That we are national, we build a national identity, but a national identity that is cosmopolitan, that is created on cosmopolitan foundation. It is a vision that recognizes that ultimately there's a sense of solidarity between all of us who are members of the human race. And that solidarity is what must permeate both our conduct, our programming, etc. So we speak about what we are today, the challenges of what we are, the beauty of what we are. Because I think sometimes we forget how beautiful a society we also are. That in all the dirt that comes out, we forget that in the sad stories about around AIDS and the failures at some level of an adequate public response to the HIV/AIDS question, there are women in the most destitute of circumstances that are taking children from the streets around them, orphan children, and feeding them. That speaks to questions of solidarity in a way that the beauty of our society far more than anything else. You know, we've just done a study which you might find fascinating, and it's a study on giving in South African society. One of the things we found is, and the book is coming out in a month's time, one of the things we found is that South Africans give on a monthly basis 930 million rand every month towards poverty alleviation and development. 930 million rand. That suggests a sense of camaraderie that far surpasses anything else I've seen anywhere else. So this is a fractious society. But it's a society involved in one of the most beautiful experiments. And so, you're right. I want to speak about the future. I will say this is what the CT looks like, and our programming must be about it. And some of it actually does do that. If you look at the nature of our circles even, they speak to a world that is beyond race. And that is fantastic. But it also does mean that we have to cover the other dirt that happens in our society, both the positives and negatives of our contemporary society. And sometimes we get the balance wrong. And sometimes we're too driven by the desire to make money or to get ratings. And so we stress the one or the other. But ultimately we have to do both. And ultimately it's about balance. Because if you don't strike balance, we lose the essence of what it means to be both a sustainable but a public broadcaster.
Thank you, Prof.
Before?
Thank you, Chairperson. Professor, you spoke earlier about your view of the need to prioritize the poor and marginalized communities, and should you be appointed to the board, one of the issues that I think will keep coming up, and it's certainly at the hot button now, is the issue of sports of national interest, and in particular the PSL deal and the high drama that the SABC finds itself in, but more so the poor and marginalized communities, particularly radio and obviously terrestrial television programs, where this is something of huge importance to South Africans, and to be deprived of it. Or deprived in one respect, or be allowed to view, but on a sort of later after the game's over sort of thing, that SABC can perhaps buy it for a cheaper rate or whatever, which obviously takes away the immediacy of having a nation at one watching in time program. So we have a situation where there is a viewpoint that would have been expressed by another candidate, that, you know, this is the market talking, that although there are concerns about what I would term outrageous commissions being paid, I'd like to, my quick question really is, what is your view on the SABC and the country at large, and indeed this parliament, government, looking at sports of national interest, in fact, not being able to be siphoned off from the public broadcaster, or indeed stations that allow the kind of terrestrial outreach to citizens as a whole. So that's really sort of the one question, and then just a quick one on which is linked to it in a way. You've written about the need to foster national unity and a sense of South African national identity. Following on from what you've said, How would you do that on a whole range of issues, not you know, including sport and the issues of, for instance, local content? Thank you.
Well, let me address both issues, but again, starting from first principles. I want to be very clear. And probably people do know this. I'm not a great fan of the market. We're leading away, and let me be clear. I'm not a great fan of an unregulated market. I believe that if you leave the market on its own, and I know there's a strong body of opinion both within the business community and in other circles, that believe that everything that can be resolved is by simply letting the market operate. I believe what you end up doing in a highly unequal society like South Africa's is you simply replicate the divisions of the past. So for me, markets are useful, but they're only useful insofar as they regulate it. So far as public authorities regulate them in a way that they are meant to achieve the kinds of desired ends that they are intended for. So for me, I think, and let me be blunt, I think soccer is a national sport in a way that no other sport does. It is not only a national sport, in a racial sense. It is fundamentally a sport of the poor. It is where the poor particularly gravitate. These are the symbols for their pastime. And for them to be denied this process is having the right to see the PSL games, for them to be allowed to, and to allow that to go to a channel that services an elite, a minority in our society, I think it's completely unacceptable. I think it's a violation, it's a travesty of justice, frankly. And so for me, I think this needs to be some serious reconsideration. And the first question I want to ask is, what went wrong here? How is it that we lost it? Is there something that went wrong on our side? The second is, if this is simply about money, then of course we need to regulate it in a way that makes sure that it happens within the framework of that citizens' interests are represented, that the majority of our citizens are given the privilege of appreciating the culture, and ultimately that's what sport is, the culture that is the predominant instrument of our society. And so some form of regulation has to happen. The precise nature of that, one needs to actually diagnose the problem first. And I would rather say, I would love to, if I was on the board, sit and see, where does the problem lie? What went wrong? Now, how do we fix the problem? The goal is exactly the same. Poor people in our society should not be having to watch PSL games after rich people do. It's an unacceptable situation. And it's an unacceptable situation in our country. It's an unacceptable situation anywhere else in the world. And I think that that's something that we need to be very clear about. On the question of national identity, you know, for me, you want to see national identity, the beauty of it is reflected in children. And I see this in my kids. They go to work, to school, and I see their interactions with friends. And it fascinates me how different they are from what I was. How, even when they recognize race, what they mean by it is fundamentally different questions. So, when you get a five-year-old who talks about color, for him or her, color is a fundamentally different thing to how I saw color 15, 20 years ago. For me, color was saturated with issues of power. It was saturated with issues of exploitation and oppression and hierarchy. I've seen kids in the school where my children are talk about color in a completely literal sense without any infusion of power. So I'm under no illusion that our society is as unequal as they are. These children will be sucked into some of the disability. But it is the beauty of our future, right? It is what the great goal of a cosmopolitan nation needs to be. And it seems to me that how do you do it? And it comes back to the earlier question. We first need to understand why is it that we can't reach it? Why is it that we're not reaching that kind of society? And it seems to me we need to speak about the problems of the present. And those questions mean we have to ask some hard questions, both from all of us. How is it that our society, 13 years, we have such unequal levels of racial discrimination? Why is it that poor, marginalized voices, mainly black, I might add, in the deepest of rural areas, completely marginalized from any discourse, in the public broadcaster, in public institutions? Why is it, and I challenge you, all actually, is there such unanimity that sits around the table between the DA and the ANC and others that are macroeconomic policies? Yet the same macroeconomic policies have had facilitated the levels of inequality in our society. And that I think all of us have to ask, because it seems to me that if you don't address inequality, for poverty you have to address, but if you don't address inequality, the future is not there. You can't have a non-racial future, because they're inextricably tied to each other. The levels of socioeconomic inequality are fundamentally tied to the nature of race in our society. And so you have to tackle the problems of today. But as you tackle the problems of today, you can, in a multiplicity of ways, reflect the future of the beauty of tomorrow. I've seen in soapies on SABC stations how race is transcended in interactions, but it's also implicit in the interactions. That's a beauty. That's an example of how you could do it. I think we need to speak much more about our future. We need to be much more international in our coverage, that we do too little of that. We need to be much more integrated within the African discourse, and I mean by that as a continental discourse, both positive and negative, that we do too little of. I think we need to reflect. There's a whole series of programming that is done in Nigeria and Kenya and in other parts of our country. Why isn't that reflected? If we want to be a cosmopolitan broadcaster, reflect that in our programming, in our news, in our thing. So it's the multiplicity of, it seems to me that's it. You can capture it in who we choose, who our cast of actors are, what the lines of plot are, in the actual news, in the broadcasters, in the anchor people. In every implicit discourse of the institution, we need to reflect both the future and the current, both the negative and the positive, both the national and the cosmopolitan. It's ultimately about balance. And how that balance gets struck is broadly a strategic plan by the executive management that works within the broad framework of goals that are enunciated by a board. If you push the line and don't give the executive management that responsibility, if they're not doing it, then you've got to ask, why aren't they doing it? Is the goal inappropriate? Or are they not playing by the broader goals off the board itself, not the nation as a whole? For me, that's the real thing. At the moment, there are multiplicity of voices. I suspect that there's a large degree of consensus if we are able to have conversations and not speak against cross purposes. Sorry.
So thank you, Prof. This has turned into a lecture now. I think your students are enjoying it. You had one of your former students was sitting at the back there saying, "That's my professor."
Yeah.
I've noted that. The slight but influential touch. That's what the professor said. I ask Mr. Schwartz, Mr. Kumalo, Ms. Yenge.
Sure, thank you. Professor, thank you. This is very entertaining and also nice interaction. I need to get back to the sports of national interest with you. Some of my other questions have been covered by you, even answers you anticipated before the questions were asked and various other things. And I don't think we should get into a long debate about this, but I beg to differ a bit in terms of the market of national sports, and I want to explain why. Around about 2001, I was a member of a parliamentary task team from the Sports and Recreation Portfolio Committee that dealt with ETV, Supersport, and the SABC, exactly on the issue of sports of national interest. Now then, soccer wasn't the issue because it was available, it was being shown, it wasn't the PSL. And to get back to the PSL problem, you're quite right, I think we should find what is really behind the whole thing, where did we miss the ball or miss the goal, whatever the case may be. But the interesting thing, and what you are saying in terms of negating market, and that way losing track of the professional nature of sport, but also in voicing the absolute imperative that the people must be able to see this without having to resort to pay channel TV. It's very much what the SABC put forward then. But then it wasn't about soccer, then it was about rugby and cricket. Now, I would argue that there may be some difference there, but for purposes of market force and purposes of professional sport, we need to at least throw them all in the basket when you talk about principles. But the argument then was that they could not afford, SABC could not afford to pay for rugby rights and cricket rights to show to the people, which were not that much in those days, but during those periods they had, if I remember correctly, a 3-year contract to show Formula One Grand Prix on SABC, where for many, many years South Africa had no interest in at all in terms of participants. We, for many years, didn't have any Grand Prix in South Africa itself, and they paid enormous money to attain those rights. Now that's if it's not hypocrisy itself, it's really bordering on hypocrisy. And I think that is the argument, that whilst you would say that, of course, there are various sports of national interest. And I wouldn't say just soccer. I agree with soccer. But also somehow, I mean, we've got there's been this old idea that the previous advantage people of our country were not interested in rugby and cricket. That's nonsense. We know what happened to faith many years ago. We know that's not the case. Indeed, there's a lot of interest there. And there should be certain means of making that available to the masses that can't afford to pay some team. But before you do that, before you argue the unavailability of funding, you need to take cognizance of market forces, of course, and the professional, as I said, professional way sport is nowadays. Otherwise you're going to move back to mature sports and South Africa will not be a factor in world sports at all. And that will be actually worse than not being able to see it immediately, but rather an hour later. But first of all, you need to look at the financial situation of the SABC in terms of budgeting, in terms of monies available for the acquirement of sport broadcasting rights. Because let me tell you, not only myself, but the rest of the people from Parliament on that committee, which we shared there, couldn't but buy the argument that if they have money to pay for F1 Grand Prix series, they should have money to buy sporting rights of national sports where South Africa participates. So just some take on that, please, if you...
Well, again, let me say, I'm not arguing for a negation of the market. I'm arguing for the regulation of the market. And I think that's an important difference. And I think your case is an absolute one. If you can't pay for cricket and rugby, but yet you can pay for Formula One, then how do you justify this? But for me, the question is, the fact that there is hypocrisy doesn't mean that you can't have regulation. All it makes the case for is you need to deal with the hypocrisy. And that's why I say we need to understand where the problem lies. And address the hypocrisy, and we need to address that particular issue. But I think this is a very graphic example I'm going to use. You're a young 17-year-old young man located in Tembisa. Your lifeblood is about soccer. In the unequal society you live in, it is one of the few privileges you have. And suddenly, the soccer match, or whatever other game some game of national interest, sport of national interest, is suddenly taken away from us. It is a travesty of justice. Now, how do we ensure that that doesn't happen? We make sure that we regulate the market. There are rules that come into play. And by the way, the regulation of the market is not a South African invention. It happens all over Western Europe. It happens in the United States. It happens all over the world. It is true, by the way, that there is a professionalization ethic in the sport. You know, and I'm sorry to speak about the study we just done. We just had a fascinating study on race and redress. What is the effect of redress in our society over the last 10 years? And one of the case studies we did, we commissioned a study on soccer. And how do you achieve sport? And the fascinating thing is, this case study speaks about how soccer as a game has gone global and has gone commercial. Yet the World Cup is fundamentally premised on the principle of nationality. And there's a tension. So when Benny McCarthy wants to play for South Africa, he gets paid, I don't know what it is, 15 grand, 20,000. When he plays for Rovers, what does he get paid? £100,000. There's such a disjuncture that the structure of the commercialization of the sport itself fundamentally erodes or creates serious tensions with the achievement of national objectives, like the creation of a demographically representative national team. How do you address that? It seems to me you can't wish it away. You can't say, well, we're going to let the market resolve it. You're going to say, excuse me, we're going to look at this market. We're going to see what the tensions are. We're going to regulate the market in a way that makes sense. Now, that sometimes might mean it comes back to Parliament and says, if you want, as our Constitution does, we are to achieve a demographically representative national team in soccer, and given the commercialization and globalization of sport, we are going to need more public resources. Any choices in life have consequences, positive and negative. You're going to analyze where the negatives lie, and look at mechanisms to resolve it. But I haven't seen a single case over my last 18 years of professional life where the market on its own operated. It always requires a level of regulation, a level of analysis, and then you say, I need to rejig in this particular way. Whether through the provision of public resources, whether through the mechanism of regulation, whether through the creation of other stakeholders. We've used other multiple mechanisms in the economy. Sometimes we put money into this around black economic empowerment and small business development. Sometimes we've regulated it by developing a financial charter. How you do it differs. But the fact that you need some level of regulation and some level of intervention is absolutely crucial.
Yes, Prof. I've got Yengeni, Mr. Kumalo, thank you for the last one.
It's not that I want an opportunity. I just thought it might be useful if perhaps you reminded everyone concerned that our laws do in fact intervene. They require the ministers of sport and communications to sit down regularly and write a list of those fixtures, games and matches which are of national interest and which may not be broadcast exclusively by those who pay the money for them. So we actually have what is called anti-siphoning legislation on the book. I'm not sure that the ministers have written the list, but I don't know anything about the sport.
Thank you, Professor. Prof, if you were to be appointed to serve in this new board, what would be your approach in encouraging the plurality of views to be heard without interfering with the management? I know you've talked about the slight influential touch. I know it's going to be difficult. I mean, it's not going to be easy for you to say exactly ATC because you are not in that situation now. But can you tell us what is that you have in mind in general? How can you change the mindset of the personnel of the newsroom to be in line with what is expected of the public broadcaster, taking into account the education, informing the public, etc.?
Let me again start from the first principle. I mean, for me, the role of a public broadcaster in educating the public, which I think is, by the way, a very important role, both about our future, but from where we are at the moment. The way you educate the public is not by articulating a single view. The way you're articulating it, because you assume that your citizens have a level of maturity that far surpasses anybody, any other society I know, frankly, partly because it's such a politicized society. And so what you wanted to actually do is allow for a contestation of ideas, and it's through engaging with that contestation of ideas that you see the processes of education actually happening. The worst thing you could actually, in my years of experience, the worst thing you could do in teaching a group of political science 1 students, the political science 3 students, to stand up there in front and give them a line. They very rarely learn it. Put in a context where there's 4 or 5 of them arguing about a particular point, and then the processes of learning happen far more dramatically because people get engaged in the process. The question for me is, how do you do it? And for me, I'm going to learn lessons from where we are at the moment. I mean, the interesting thing about where I stay at the moment is this is how the board works. The board says to me, we have a multiplicity of requests. We need you to do research that has a public end. So you must do applied research that government can utilize and public authorities can utilize. They say, but we want that research of a quality that could, it must be founded on scholarship, because it must be cutting edge. And we want to do this in a financially sustainable way. Now, very rarely does the board get involved in the actual decision. It comes to the CEO, Al Chisano, and then it comes to its executive directors, people like myself, and says, now we want a strategic plan for you to do this. And it, they establish a set of indicators for me, one of which is my publication number. We want you to see that you achieve a comparable publication rate to other universities in the country. We want you to be financially sustainable. We want to see your public mandate being taken up by reflected by how much it's being utilized by government departments, by how much your networking, who your stakeholders are, who commissions your research, etc. So there's a set of benchmark indicators by which they measure me. They don't tell me the plan, they give me the benchmark indicators. It's for me to develop the plan. Now, if I was at the SABC, that's for me the approach that one develops. Slight, but influential touch. How do you do it? You say, look, our purpose is to articulate a plurality of views. We want to be firstly engaged in the public. Secondly, we want to ensure that a multiplicity of views are engaged in her, so that our journalistic data feel they reflect a plurality of views, they engage each other, that there is discourses that take place, that allow for investigative journalism for you, if you like, that our journalists feel empowered and enabled and do not feel threatened. And there's easy ways to measure that. You can, on an annual basis, do a scorecard by which to assess how your journalists, your cadre of journalists feel across the radio and television networks, and whether they feel that they can articulate the views that they want, whether they can choose the candidates that they want. Are your producers allowed to produce the stories they want? Those are easy mechanisms to do. You can look at viewership and how viewership is constructed. Is it constructed mainly in northern Johannesburg suburbs, people like myself? Or does a broader cadre of a broader section of society actually look at that? And it's through the indicators that you begin to assess. You don't assess by saying, I think you should do this, because that's the real danger. Your real danger is then you're undermining the role of executive management. Your purpose is set the plan, the goals, set the indicators by which you get measured. See, these are collective, and that, by the way, is a collective process. It's not imposed by the board. And now say, we measure you. We expect every 6 months for you to be saying to us, where are you on publication? In my case, where are we on publication? But in this case, where are we on how a journalist in the newsroom feel? Where are we on how executive producers feel? Where are we on viewership ratings? Where are we on the nature of the change of programming? What is the mix of programming that we have? Have we increased current affairs programs vis-a-vis sexy pornography programs? You know, you create a set of indicators by which you measure this. And then ultimately that's how you do this. I think the worst thing you could do is say, this is what you do, because then you undermine the process of executive management.
Which? We'll go to the last one, which is Dr. Kumalo.
Thanks, Professor Abib, in your master's dissertation that you wrote on the politics of the South African Communist Party between 1962 and 1991. I just want to check with you, do you think that in the light of the Communist Party's issue of socialism in the future, that the broadcaster will be able to be pro oppressed working class and be able to come with programs that do not necessarily perpetuate a materialistic, consumerist type of capitalist ideology as it does now with the current broadcasting corporation? Secondly, your PhD dissertation on the structures, measures, and decision-making, side of South African transition to democracy. In the course of your dissertation as you did it, did you manage to capture what should be the South African direction or trajectory? What should be, what we pride ourselves in, you know, South Africanness? And that's the second point. The third point, Chairperson, do you understand the mandate of the South African Broadcasting Company? Do you understand its mandate? And if you do, what is its mandate? If you're not, I would also expect it maybe partly to refer back to the Broadcasting Act if you've got some time. The fourth question, Chairperson, is what is the current funding model of the broadcaster, and are you do you have any proposal of what should it be, so that that plurality of ideas, multiplicity of views, is captured without being compromised in the altar of commercialization? In the altar of commercialization, Ms. Sinsman. No, you don't have to say anyone. Your look just make me to call your name. I'm just saying that's the fourth question. Now, the last question is that Professor Jacqueline Cock, when she came here, she's of an opinion that you must actually have a sociologist or a political scientist, and he mentioned your name and that he saw a student that was applied. And I'm aware that you and her have written quite a number of stuff, and two, going back to the South African Labour Bulletin, those years with Eddie Webster and Maurice, what was his name? Maurice Yusura, I just forgot his name. Yes, Maurice. And I think also Mark Hawking used to write quite a lot from Cape and stuff like that. I think it's of opinion that you need somebody, a sociologist or a political scientist, somebody public policy, who can exercise the board from time and again to be able to understand the political dynamics, issues and stuff like this, not necessarily going into intricate political issues of each political party. What is your view of that? Not necessarily that I'm saying, what is your view or whether should you be the person or not? What is your view about the board having a person of that nature able to understand issues of labor, politics, public policy, and them? So those are my questions, Chairperson. Oh yeah, the last question, Chair. The last question is your writings and your involvement in the social movement, and as they have arose in the past 10 years, whether it's international and also national. Are you in any way involved in the social movement by office, being an office bearer, or just at a level funding, or because I've seen where you're quite involved in the Maritzburg social movement and stuff like that? There are such movements in Johannesburg and around that, anti-privatization forums, the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, many, quite of them have been quite anti-government, some have been quite engaging. You know, but I'm, of course, the portfolio committee always accommodate different and divergent, so just want to check your involvement with them. Thank you.
Well, let me start off with the last question. I've effectively done studies of the social movements, but I am not a member of any of the social movements themselves. I think I did play a role three or four years ago in the anti-war movement when the Iraq war took place, and there were a series of marches, and I addressed some of those rallies around that. But I am not an active member of any of the movements out there, but I have studied them, and we've written a book on that subject. Let me quickly go through some of the questions you raised. Do I think the public broadcaster, given some of my writings on the FACP, do I think the public broadcaster could be a public broadcaster? Look, I think one's got to firstly remember that we live in a capitalist society. And as I said to you, the public process has to both reflect the future, but it has to reflect the current. And for me, it's not going to become, whether you like it or not, and whether anybody wants it or not, it's not going to become a Marxist public broadcaster that articulates the views of the proletariat. It's just impossible in the kind of society that we are. But I do think that doesn't mean that voices of marginalized communities can be heard. That stories about, as I gave you the example of women in townships feeding AIDS orphans cannot be told. That interests of these people are not raised and articulated in a variety of ways. And those stories need to be told in a way that they aren't told. And they're not told in the commercial media, and they're not, sometimes they're done in the public broadcaster, but not as effectively as it should. So, but we are going to reflect, and I was very clear, I think we're going to reflect the plurality of views. And that means that you would have to reflect both the views of powerful interests in our society, but also the views of others. And it's in the, what I call, as I say, corny as it sounds, it is in the contestation of the empowered stakeholders that, that the real mandate of the public broadcaster gets defined. The PhD dissertation, what should be the trajectory? This is my study. You're giving me a, my favorite question. My favorite question is, why has South Africa gone the way it's done? Some great successes over the last 12, 13 years. But there's been some weird weaknesses. Unemployment is a big issue. Inequality levels is a big issue. What happened? And for me, the one thing that I carry on saying is the reason that sometimes poor people's interests are forgotten is because dear poor people don't have leverage. And my entire political trajectory and my entire intellectual trajectory is to work out mechanisms where poor people can get leverage. Against economic elites, against political elites, against anybody. Because the day development truly happens, if you look at comparative cases of Western Europe, or you look at comparative cases of Southeast Asia, development happens when poor people are managed through a variety of circumstances, get leverage, they get power. In the Western European case, they got power because there was unionization, huge unions in the end of the Second World War, which allowed them to be mobilized in a way that does things. In our society, a vibrant civil society is absolutely crucial for leverage of poor people, which is why I think, whether you agree with these movements or not, the purpose of these social movements, and I said this in the book, the purpose of these, the real value, whether you agree with their goals or not, their real value is they enable poor people to get leverage against a variety of elites, whether that, that elite is an economic elite as a local business owner, or whether that elite is a political office bearer or whatever. And for me, that's the fundamental question. The trajectory of our transition, some great successes, some humongous failures. And if we're going to address those failures, we fundamentally need to think about how to make sure that poor people have power. And that, for me, is the big question. Whether through social movements, whether through enhancing the leverage. One of my big criticisms about poor people not having leverage is because political parties cannot represent them. One of my big criticisms of opposition parties is precisely on this question, that they have not been able to become a source where poor people, or black people more generally, but poor people in particular, feel that their interests are represented in those things, in those organizations. And that's the big challenge that confronts our society. That's the systemic weakness. On the question of the mandate, I know the mandate in its broadest terms. And the mandate, as I understand it, is there are multiplicity of things that a public broadcaster does. And my, for me, I look at this in relation not only into relation to the SABC, but in relation to some of the some of what happens internationally. The public broadcaster does a couple of things. Its mandate is to enhance, to articulate, as somebody said, a discourse that represents the nation, that enhances public discourse in the nation as a whole. That's its fundamental mandate. However that's articulated, but that's its fundamental mandate. Its fundamental mandate is to enhance local programming in its articulation, in its public demeanor. It's to fund the creation of a new generation of demographically representative producers. It's to fund a new generation of programs that speak to what the society is, but what its aspirations are meant to be, that speak to the values of our society. And it seems to me that a public broadcaster's public discourse, to enhance the public discourse, to represent the nation, and to represent fundamentally what the future is in its multiplicity of ways. Now, how does it do this? Like all public institutions, it operates in a market environment, and it's got to do this in a financially sustainable way, which brings me to the financial model. The financial model for me is there's an enormous reliance on the market itself. There's an enormous reliance on advertising revenue. And there's benefits in that. But, you know, even we've been very successful at HSRC. We get about 40% of our funds from Parliament. 60% of our funds are generated. A large percentage of those funds are generated from government departments, but nevertheless they exist. And we found that there's huge tension. I myself found that there's huge tension. I'm so busy trying to balance the books that sometimes I drop questions. If a poor NGO were to walk into the room and say to me, and I've had people from Parliament phone me and say, we want you to do A, B, C, and D, and I have to ask them, do you have any money for it? Because I've got to make up 60% of my budget. And that dilemma, if there are public mandates, we've got to start seriously thinking about public resources to fund those mandates. That's something we've got to live with. It doesn't come, listen, you can't expect your manager to simply operate in the basis of the market and then not have it. So there is some space that we're going to start thinking, and I don't know the precise mechanics of this, but it seems to me that we need to start thinking about what are the resources deployed, how much of the resources, what is the fair amount of the resources. I wouldn't argue for a public broadcaster that is fundamentally 100% funded. I think it doesn't create the competitive spirit. I think it doesn't allow you to start marking a plan, and you need to mark a plan in any public institution. And that competitive spirit, it seems to me, has to come from a mix. And that's where I was missing. I'm not so sure we've struck the right mix. The issue is not about the mix. It's where does the mix get struck? And for me, that's the big question. Finally, do I think Jackie's suggestion? I'm not so sure. You know, for me, what is important in this board is, and I don't think it needs to be one, you need a number of people who understand the dilemma. Firstly, you need a multiplicity of stakeholders represented. Secondly, you need the board and all of these people understanding both what we are as a society and where we want to be. That understand, you might not need to agree, that understand what the dilemmas that confront labor are, but also what the dilemmas that confront business are. Now, does that mean you need a political scientist? And I'm sure my colleagues in the political science fraternity would be horrified and say, I don't think political scientists are the only ones who do this. You need, in my view, a set of public intellectuals. People who understand the world of politics, the world of our society, the world of culture, the world of economics. You don't need to know the finer technicalities of the process. But ultimately, you need to understand the world about creation discourse. How do you facilitate discourse? How do you manufacture it? I would like to see much more less a political scientist or a sociologist or a psychologist. I'd rather you have two or three public intellectuals from a variety of disciplinary boundaries that are able to cross to become transdisciplinary in that sense. And for me, that's the real issue. Whether that should be me, for Jackie Cock or anybody else, that's not for me to decide. I think that's for you to decide, bearing in mind who you have and the mix of skills you've got in front of you. Thank you.
Prof, we're coming to the end of this. I'm going to give you just a minute to just a minute to you know, they're already starting to be excited, consulting whether we should confirm your appointment now. Mm-hmm. They say, no, stop it.
I thought you were saying you didn't because I called you as a captain.
No, they don't say that we'll give you that minute just to just say your closing remarks. You had actually taken longer, but I think it was useful. The communists are saying, Communist Kumalo is saying, socialism is the future, you must build it now. That's what they're saying. I'm not sure your take on that. One of the clever guys, I find among the Communist Party members are very clever people, I don't know. I'm still trying to look around. Saying that education, because you are in that field, is just transferring of knowledge from the dead to the living. Is it fair? Lastly, how many boards do you serve on currently? As you answer, as you give all those closing remarks, you can answer the last question in particular.
Well, look, it's been a great pleasure. Let me thank you for this. This has been a real honor, and it's been particularly the things get exciting when there's a robust engagement, and I like that. So thank you very, very much for that. On the issue of the board, which I think is an important question, I sit on one EXCO, I think three boards, but they all are NGOs. And that means that my involvement is slight. It means actually, one or two meetings a year, as a general rule. I sit on the Harold Voltaire School Trust. I sit on the Center for Policy Studies, the Center for Public Participation, There's a number of other boards I sit, but I've actually no longer sit on them anymore. And that's something that's worth bearing. The two boards that I did sit on that took up a lot of time were council meetings at the university, and that I don't sit on anymore. I used to sit on the Devon Institute of Technology, and I don't sit on the board anymore. But I must be honest as well that one of the things that I am doing, and it's in bearing this, it's not only in relation to the what happens here as part of this process, but given the fact that I am becoming the Deputy Vice Chancellor of the University of Johannesburg, one of the things that I will be doing very soon is beginning to review how many things I should be doing and how many disciplines. But at the moment, frankly, whether it's the Center for Policy Studies, the Harvard Walpole Trust, or the Center for Public Participation, my role is not onerous in the sense that it would be if you were sitting on a formal business board, which you know requires much more levels of engagement than the NGO.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for having me,
and good luck. Thank you very much.
Okay. Members, we're just going to take your tea and come back. We'll take in the next 5 minutes, the next...
the media, the advertising, printing and publishing theater towards the direction of developing future leaders for those different sectors. I also sit on the board of the Marketing Association of South Africa, which is a 14-member team made of directors of your biggest companies in the country. And once again, I represent an element of youth within that particular board. But most importantly, I mean, we sit there with the likes of the marketing director of SAB. I talk of Tiger Brands, I talk of Unilever. And we've got a market influence in terms of rent and cents who mainly spend, who mainly generate the revenue that SABC makes. I mean, we control over 20 billion rand amongst the board. And I'm one of the members of the Tunde. And I also sit within the advertising industry, one of the most significant bodies within the advertising industry that influenced, once again, the transformation and the democratization of the industry, which is one of the least transformed industry bodies, which is the Communications and Advertising Forum for Empowerment. And we influence thinking, direction, and where the industry needs to be going to, and the power that you'd understand what the role that advertising plays in the country. It's fundamentally important in terms of directing perceptions, but ultimately, with the Marketing Association of South Africa, we influence, and we also play a major role in the sustainability of organizations like the South African Broadcasting Corporation with regards to the advertising expenditure. Because without advertising, there would be no content. There won't be any television. I mean, if you look at the major revenue generated from SABC that makes them sustainable as a business, comes from advertising. And I sit on that board. I also advise, and I'm a member of the South African Youth Council. I also advise as well organizations like the Congress of South African Students. I'm a true representative of the young, dynamic, new dispensation of people in this country who have an understanding of business principles and also social, and also I think within this environment, political as well. So in a nutshell, that is who I am. I'm also qualified as a marketer. I've got a national diploma. I'm in the process of completing in the next month a specialist degree in marketing, which is brand communication. And simultaneously with another institution, I'm going to be completing my supply chain. It's basically a procurement diploma with Boston College. So academically, I'm also quite strong. I have an understanding of marketing, understanding of the media, and fundamentally, understanding of the broadcasting sector in the country.
Why do you want to be on the SABC board?
Fundamentally important, I mean, the role that SABC plays in the country is to influence perceptions, is to democratize society, is to inform, educate, and entertain, but using relevance. And I want to be one of the people who direct the thinking and the vision and make sure that is articulated in the process of doing business on a day-to-day basis. I just want to advise and also have the influence of how we need to accomplish that particular objective. But most importantly, it is a mandate. And I want to be part of those thought leaders who dictate or rather direct those kind of thinking.
So I'm going to look for takers, but I've seen one already. What is your current relationship with the SABC, if any?
It's more from protecting the industry that I represent, which is the marketing society, which is the marketing industry. It's not really direct. It's at a distance. So I'd like to say, Mr. Chairperson, there is no direct relationship that I have on a personal level with the SABC. It's through the Marketing Association where last week we sat down with the CEO and raised a couple of concerns from industry to say, why is SABC unilaterally increasing their fees in terms of advertising? And the Marketing Association, driven by its members, took a decision to say, your way of doing business needs to change. There's no reason that you've given us that is sufficient. I mean, you haven't given us sufficient reasons of why you've increased your fees by 40%. And based on that, we had a discussion with the executive team of SABC to say, you either change, you consult, or we boycott SABC. And I was part of the delegation to, that represents the marketing industry, to say, get your house in order. So that has been my interaction with the SABC. I've also worked in the past for an organization, which is an initiative as a consultant, brand management consultant, which was the My Acre of Africa initiative, where it was a partnership between South African National Parks and SABC, and I worked very closely with the SABC with regards to branding, flighting of adverts, and the creation of awareness of the particular initiative through the different platforms that the SABC has, that is radio and the radio stations.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, Mr. Masaloha, Mr. Swart, Mr. Kumalo.
Chairperson, I'm trying to work out that which I think is a kind of a contradiction. Here we're trying as a committee to... Well, let me restart. Currently, the ad industry contributes 80%. Of the funding of the public broadcaster, so significant to a point where it can somehow gently, unintentionally direct or give direction to the public broadcaster needs to and will be moving in. Now, here you come as a significant player, strong player, sitting on all these boards and where you find yourself as employment, MEPSIT included. So this is a contradiction. Here we're trying to move away, and yet that kind of influence could be coming from you if you should be appointed among the 12 and still retain that position. That kind of influence, I think, can't be healthy. Because I can see there will be an increase in terms of that kind of influence from 80% even more.
I think in any business transaction or any transaction that should I be successful, I mean, I can always recuse myself. I'm involved within a particular academic institution within advertising. Yet I sit on the board of the advertising chamber of MAPSITA. Whenever a decision is made, which is law within the country, you're not allowed to influence, to give your opinion. It's commonly termed you need to recuse yourself, and that is a process that I would undertake should I be appointed. But I think the role that I would play if I am successful would be to mobilize the young people of the country, which I very strongly feel I'm a true representative of. I also have very strong understanding of business. But to answer your question, is that a conflict of interest? I do not think so. I think the role that I also play is to also educate the code, the team of people who I sit on the board with, on the fundamental role that SABC plays and rightfully should be playing in this country, which I feel they don't clearly understand. I mean, as marketers, they're just trying to reach as many people as they can to sell a particular brand. Do the people that are sitting around the table that have an understanding, an intrinsic understanding of the demographic profile and the people that we're speaking to through the national broadcaster? No, they don't. So it is our responsibility, as may I use the word, as caterers within that particular group, to educate, to advise, and to assist in terms of thinking. That is the role that ours are playing. And to educate them and motivate them to spend more, we should allow us to reach out more to the outlying communities and do what the SABC as an organization is rightfully mandated to do, to be more, much more effective in terms of its operation.
Thank you. No,
thanks, Mr. Damini. Happy to see you again. And just three brief questions. Can you perhaps enlighten us, because you see, you've got certain media forms with high volumes of audience, and yet they don't receive a corresponding, you know, expense. And on the one hand, you have those that have got small listenership, like SAFM, Metro, Sonascribe and so on, which receive high volumes of ad spend compared to Ukozi and so on. What is the thinking there? Because I suppose the marketers themselves also distort diversity or those media forms that basically speak to the black people. The second is, it follows from the first question that was asked, you know, how do you balance the interest of marketers, advertisers, in an instance where you become a board member of the SABC vis-a-vis the interest of the SABC? You spoke about an agitation of marketers or advertisers to boycott SABC because SABC has taken a particular view in terms of increasing advertising revenue. So if you were in the board of the SABC at the time when this matter was being considered, what would have been your approach coming from the industry and also serving as a board member? But the last is your impression about what you think the adverts, the impact of adverts on youth. You know, what kind of values do you think that the adverts that we see and read about both on the SABC and print media, the values that it imprints on young people? Do they display and cherish achievement or, you know, wealth exhibition and great? Do they engender values of responsible consumption or, you know, consumerism? What's your impression?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Comrade, good to see you again.
You must just clarify where you saw each other. We've always got guessing wrong things to you.
Yeah.
Change the publicly. We're hoping that you would say privately, good to see you again, good to see you again. But you're saying it publicly, now just explain it.
No. In my other life, we speak to young professionals and young entrepreneurs. So he's one of them.
Oh, okay. That was good. All right. Good to see you again.
Thank you, sir. And most recently, it was in these corridors of power where we met the youth month. The term Julangengoko regarding youth issues in Parliament. Sure, so I was involved in that. Just to answer your question, I'll start with the advertising expenditure question. It is rather unfortunate, and there's no scientific reason. And the role that we play as people that come from the demographic profiles, representing the masses who sit on those structures that direct people's influence or other thinking, and, through advertising, one of the things that we've always tried to educate them on, and which the process continues, is spend more with these people, because they are the people that consume your product and your brand. Most unfortunately, the people sitting within the different advertising agencies and the guys in this country who control the marketing budgets, which is billions of rands, tend to be still white. It's an industry, both from an advertising and also from a marketing division, still white. So I think the role that we are playing as young kids is to educate them on why they need to spend, and that process is happening, but not at a rate that we would like it to happen at. Yes, Ukhozi is one of the largest, is the largest radio station in the country, but in terms of the advertising expenditure, it is not as big as the likes of 702, who speak to a small minority of, if you happen to be black, you're in the elitist group, if you happen to be, and majority of them are white, and we're saying that process needs to change. I don't know if I've answered that question. So it's an educational process that we continue to embark upon. And you also asked me in terms of my approach, what would my approach have been should I have been a member of the SABC board, should that particular issue had arisen then? I'll still take the position that I took then. I'm a loyal servant of the public who happens to be very patriotic as well. And my position was to, we are there deployed to educate and transform the way people operate and think. And that's the exact position that that's the position that I take. And my response to that, even though it's not the most favorable one, was there are certain reasons, and investigate that before you take a robust approach. Let us sit down and consult. Issues like inflation, prices of things go up, and the approach that you guys are taking to want to immediately boycott is uncalled for. I mean, one of the things that we as a country have been successful in is to engage, should there be an area of concern. And that's the position that I took. But in terms of making a decision on behalf of the SABC, I try to protect. And my role, once again, would be wanting to protect, to make sure that the guys continue to spend with the SABC to make it afloat and allow the SABC to go out and do what it's supposed to do as a business. So my role initially, and I'm committing to it, is going to be protecting the public, and the public broadcaster, because once again, I represent the masses. I am in those particular structures to influence, or rather, to redirect resources to a new productive means. for a new productive means, and that is the majority of people in this country. And just to also talk about the role of advertising with regards to influencing youth. Most unfortunately, we're talking of a highly untransformed area. Transformation in terms of the market that they're communicating to, how they think, how they do things, which is rather sad. I mean, if you see the communication through TV, which is, you know, majority of the communication we see is, or advertising pieces, pander to Eurocentric taste. Why? The guys don't have an in-depth understanding of how black South Africans live and how to effectively communicate to black South Africans. It's rather unfortunate. And the positive spin off should the guys be able to and successfully crack that would be much more effective than to just communicate certain messages or certain pieces to youth. The role that advertising plays in this country is much more, it's beyond comprehension. It's about positioning South Africa favorably to the rest of the country. And one of the things that we're failing is when America comes, when an American comes to South Africa currently, and they turn on the TV, they see American adverts or adverts that are to be American, and they say, are we in Africa? So the role that and the opportunity that we have to play as marketers and advertisers and what SABC has a strong opportunity to do is also influence the kind of advertising that we show in our TV to project the realities of South African society. But most importantly, from a youth perspective, it is not really reflective of the realities of South African society. It is for the, I mean, the role that SABC should be playing in terms of its advertising. When you see advertising, it shows you gangsterism is cool. To twang is cool. And those are things that break us up and do not build us up as a society or as a collective. There is a bit of work to be done, and the role that SABC can play is to educate the advertisers to create advertisements that are relevant to the youth. Because what that should do, it would motivate them to become loyalists, it should motivate them to be culturally sensitive, and it should also motivate them to be proud of their South African identity, which is not really the case currently. I mean, we have an opportunity here through advertising to educate people and to talk about the negative effects of drugs, of alcohol, how that breaks us up as a family, as a society, and as a community. And these are things that I believe, through the SABC, effective communication in partnership with the guys that control the cash, lies in terms of going out to communities, educating them, understanding them, and then coming back and crafting messages that are going to be projected through the SABC platform that are relevant to the South African society and identity. So to me, I hope I've answered them, your questions, broadly, in terms of where my heart is and my vision would be.
But let me, if you're going to answer one question for such a long time, you're going to miss your flight. So, if honorable members, if you can just be mindful of that fact, so that Mr. Lamine at least leaves here by 12, the latest. His flight is 1 o'clock, at least there is no traffic. Mr. Swart?
Sir, thank you. I'll start with brief first. Mr. Lamine, thank you. And I'm listening to your passionate remarks, and you portray yourself as a very professional person in terms of the things you're involved with. Just a start of question, Chair, to you. You accept nomination. You accept your nomination to the board of the SABC. I presume you perused the advertisement or the call for nominations. Part of that is that there should be a CV attached to the documentation. Up to today, we haven't received a CV from you. None of us. I've just checked with the staff. I've checked with the research document. I know what I've got in front of me. I haven't seen a curriculum of Klum Vita of you. Can you just address us in that regard as well? That could have gone amiss. I mean, I have to listen now to what you quickly explained what you're doing, because I was at a loss. I didn't have any information of you apart from the little short nomination and your acceptance. That's the one first thing. I don't know how it happened that you can sit here without us having had a CV of you in front of us, as that was a prerequisite of the documentation. But that matters most. I'm struggling to understand, because I'm listening to what you're saying, and you're making a passionate plea for advertisement and for marketing. And that is your background at the moment, that's why. And you also said that you've been a delegate of a delegation that went to the SABC to take them on about the increase in advertising costs and various other things. And the whole argument you make here today is from that point of view. But then your answer on the first question was that if those things come into play, you will recluse yourself. But you didn't say from which you will do so. I need to understand, you are, and I'm not, I mean, it's not a matter of arguing for vested interest or conflict of interest or things. I just want to understand. You are representing, and you're a big player, I mean, it seems to me, in marketing and advertising. And the SABC is here. Now, these people have conflicting priorities to that of the SABC, particularly when it comes to advertising and costs. You've been involved in that play against the SABC. You want to sit on the board of the SABC. You didn't give any indication that you will then sever your links with these formations, and I'm not saying you should do so. You just said you recluse yourself. You want to recluse yourself from the marketing people when they want to fight the SABC, or you want to recluse yourself from the SABC board when they discuss these things, or they have anything to do with marketing and advertising, or maybe you see the way that from this point of view, if you sit on the SABC board, you can actually influence that board to do marketing and advertising in the proper way that you think it should happen, which will not only benefit this marketing and advertising instruments that you're involved with, but that will lead to what you want from the country, what you want from the SABC to do. Do you see yourself as being from that background able to influence the SABC board to maybe not raise tariffs by 40%, because that would defeat the purpose of what you see they should do in terms of local content of advertising and fulfilling their mandate? Where do you see yourself in this? I just need some more clarification on that, please. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. To answer to Mr. Swart's questions directly, my CV was sent, and the last copy sent of my CV was sent yesterday. I don't know if you received it.
It's okay. All right.
Yes, it was sent.
It just shows that you've got some pals in high offices.
It's nice
meeting you. Ruben, I don't know whether you have got your chance.
No, I have no part.
No, that's fine. I thought it was my...
I apologize. I'm not exactly sure what happened to the CV, but yes, it was sent from my side through to your office bearer. And to answer your question directly, one of the most effective ways of change is to not to want to change things by being outside of the pot, if I may use that. To me, it is about being within the particular committee and fighting vociferously in terms of wanting to educate them as a marketing association. I, once again, would like to remind you, Mr. Swart, that I am a loyal servant of the public, and the SABC is one of the organizations that communicate to the masses and the public, which automatically means that I am extremely loyal to that. And to me is I am committed to assisting the organization no matter what one needs to do to make sure that they are able to fulfill their roles, their objectives, their mandate, whatever it takes. And one of those
I think you've made a point to say you would want to influence them not to take any literal decisions but to understand the education part. That's fine. But the issue here is now, if you've got to recuse yourself from this conflict, either from the advertisers or from the SABC, at that point, where would you recuse yourself from?
Without a doubt, I'd recuse myself from the Marketing Association Board. I'm a loyal and a loyal servant of the public, and I'll be there to defend and support the SABC.
Thanks. But they're paying you, are they not?
I beg your pardon?
They're not the one who control the dollar there. How do you take a multi-billion and go to those poor ones that is fighting the PSL for money? See what I mean?
I think it's all about influence. I mean, if you look at one of the boys that sits on the board has now spent, I mean, quite a large amount of money with the PSL. And one of the things that you're influencing him is that you also need to invest the same amount in terms of advertising expenditure with the SABC, which is Ian Peniel from SABC, I mean from South African Breweries. I mean, that's just spent about 5 billion rand over the next couple of years in terms of in soccer in the country. I mean, that's a significant. And what we do is we're trying to motivate and influence them in terms of this is the guys that they need to spend with, and here are the reasons why they need to spend them with. One of the things that we're also doing is wanting to transform the organization so that we have more black people at those decision-making boards to say, this is where we're spending our money, and this is where we are most loyal to.
Mr. Kuna and then Mr. Inge,
sorry. Kia lebo kamudila stulo. Babu Lami, I heard you in your input, you know, mentioning something about, you know, directing the thinking. Maybe it's at the board level, or let's say maybe it's at an editorial meeting. In directing this thinking, of course, bearing in mind the question of the freedom of speech, you know, considering the different ideas that might be put forth, how do you see yourself, you know, assisting when directing this thinking without closing up, you know, allowing this freedom of expression to an extent that everybody is able to see that now the broadcasting, you know, authority is independent to its maximum. To an extent where, you know, someone that cannot see does feel that, yes, this board has, you know, the interests of us, you know, in mind. And then the second question, short one, you mentioned the question of advertising. I think this is one area of concern to us. And we do agree with what you said about advertising. If you were to be nominated to the board, let me give it to you as a task. If you were to be nominated to the board, the question of the local radio station, the manner in which they are introduced to us, we the indigenous people of South Africa, it's very irrelevant. If maybe you have not realized that, just that Kaluk Cheka Baba, Tonga talk about the introduced Anjani, Sivenda talk about the introduced Anjani, and the constitution, you know, is considering its official language, you know, its culture, its tradition, and so on. So that's one area which one would like you to attend to in case we nominate you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. I'll start with the second question, and I'd also like you to then guide me with the first question in terms of directing your thinking. The first one is the communication, you know, the introduction saying African languages are indigenous. I mean, I think the process starts within the individuals. That is the legacy of where we as black people are positioned in terms of our thinking. And people, some people, most unfortunately, are still stuck to that way of communication, thinking, and expression. The process in terms of change would start to educate the people within the SABC. Because when an announcement, and when an announcer announces that in radio, the listeners also tend to think of it that way, which is, from what I'm sensing, is that it is degrading. It doesn't create a platform or a sense of pride. So the process would start in terms of, in any marketing or educational process, you start by educating the people within, who would then accentuate the particular communication message externally. So there has to be a rigorous educational campaign that would start within the organization in terms of, this is who we are. You now need to be very proud of who you are and where you come from and start addressing or using this kind of language that is modern. That is the role or the suggestion that I would put forth. To answer the second question in terms of directing the thinking, sure, there has to be, once again, without doubt, it is a platform where it's democratic, which it promotes democratization of a society. And I would not in any way, I'd like to reiterate, influence what is projected in the public ultimately. But one of the things that you would influence is that there is researched, relevant, and to the and understanding of who you're communicating to and what you're communicating about. You need to have background information and research of your communication message or piece. We do not deny or restrict freedom in terms of communication, but it has to come from a background of a source of, it has to be researched. You need to talk from a position of being informed.
The adverts are very Eurocentric, the way they are projected, and that's the matter that the advertisers have got to look into, particularly in your case where you've got education institutions and things like that, just to ensure that you take the culture and language of the African society, indigenous languages, into account when you do some of the things. I think that's the message.
Yeah.
Let's take this to Ian again.
Mr. Lamini, 80% of the SABC funding comes from the advertisers, and that is why you find that the SABC is unable to perform its mandate as a public broadcaster, because it has to dance to the music of those who contribute more. They can't bite the hand that feeds them. If you were to be appointed to the board or to serve in the new board, what would you do to see to it that situation is changed around? Or do you believe at all in what I'm saying? For instance, if you watch news, there is adverts. You have to call for adverts. That shows what I was saying. And also, I forgot the other example. But what is that you do? Or what is your comment on that?
Thank you. I think fundamentally important, and it saddens one, is for that reason that one does not want to separate one from the decision-making process and powers. One of the things that I'd like to, that I would implement is that there's a closer relationship between the two. currently it's very distant. It's just a simple process where sales executives from the SABC contact certain brand owners or custodians of particular brands and saying, here's the space available, here's the cost you advertise with us. If you don't want to, get somebody else, number one. And from the marketer's side, they're saying, this is how much we have, this is why we want to advertise, you place us on there. There isn't really a process where people are working together cohesively to an extent where we would all, both parties, like to see the process in terms of engagement to be. To answer your question directly, I'd forge a closer working relationship between the two. And the role that the role that SABC would play would be to educate in terms of this is how you need to communicate. Why is it important that you guys communicate like this? Because it becomes more effective advertising, then you see a positive projection on your bottom line as a company. One of the stories, the challenges that has been told many years back, and it's still the case today, is that 50% of advertising work. The challenge is we don't know which 50% of that advertising does not work. So this is the role that SABC would play in terms of educating, to say, here's the 50% that doesn't work, and it doesn't work because of A, B, and C. And how and when do we get to the process? It's a process of working together, teamwork, and the partnership. So that is what I'd like to see in terms of enhancing, but not compromising on the objective of the objective and the mandate of the SABC.
You'll have to start giving us your closing remarks, because I think I don't want you to miss your flight. But I think also that you've raised very fundamental issues that need the attention of those members, of these members. For instance, we've got an outstanding matter about the transformation of the marketing and the advertising industry. It's a matter that we should desist on. And you just reminded us that we forget in this important aspect. I'm just worried that it still remains untransformed and so on. What was the outcome of your meeting with the SABC when you threatened to boycott them? I mean, are they pressing ahead with the 40%? Have they stopped? And so on. As the chair of the MEP CETA, an interaction with them in terms of, your role at that particular level with the SABC?
I'm the chairperson of the MAPC Advertising Chamber. The association that we have with the South African Broadcasting Corporation was that one of the things that I did when I took up a position in 2005 as the chairperson of the MAPC Advertising Chamber was the advertising industry had existed for many years, but there was no training development program that they were currently running, informal learnership. And those are things that I'm proud to say we introduced. The same with the SABC, there's no training development leadership within the broadcasting sector of South Africa. And these are things that I've taken initiative in terms of discussing and deliberating with the SABC to say they must run it, yet it must benefit all your competitors. But what it does fundamentally benefits our people, because you've got more people within the broadcasting sector who are skilled, resourced, and can move within the different ladders and shape the thinking of the particular organization. That's my interaction currently in terms of wanting to introduce a training development program that benefits our people, majority of the youth. And in terms of the outcome of the discussion that we were waiting, it was a simple discussion document that we presented to them, to say, guys, here are our concerns. Can you please motivate us and give us reasons why you inflated your prices by 40%? It doesn't sound reasonable. They had an expo, I think, last on Monday, and we're going to be, we're waiting for feedback today. But we think it is positive. I think they went back to then address how it was done. The marketing industry is not concerned about why it was done. They're just concerned on how it was done. They're saying the process was not consultative. It was rather arrogant. And what we're saying is, no, guys. Let us communicate done. Because the guys, you're right, madam, if they control the hand, they feed us. So let us communicate with them in a nice way, but don't bow down to anything. Just be diplomatic in your approach. That's all you're saying. So we hope the outcome, and I trust the outcome is going to be positive. There's no way that these guys are going to boycott. They want to and they have to continue to selling brands. And the South African Broadcasting Corporation is one of the best platforms and most effective platforms that they have in terms of communicating to the market that they want to communicate to.
Your closing remarks, sir.
I think from my side, I'd like to say thank you to everybody for the opportunity. You have in this room a young, passionate person who has an understanding of the industry and who wants to see the organization grow from where it is to greater heights and compete with international organizations on merit, because we have the resources, we have the capabilities, and we have individuals sitting full-time at SABC. All I would like to do is be given an opportunity to assist in the process of enhancing the SABC and positioning South Africa using the SABC platform strongly to South Africans first, and secondly, to the global community at large. Thank you.
Good luck, sir. And thanks for coming. It was nice meeting you again. Okay, shall we have Mr. Silwani, please, now?
You should only ask them there who get details with you guys, you're never in trouble. Hey. No, it happens in the boardroom. Yeah. But for us, you must have a press conference.
Rita, if Mr. Silwani is not here, let's get seen there. Anybody who's here.
We must continue a press conference, have all of you. Okay, that's what.
Members, thank you for sitting down. Mr. Swart, thank you very much. Ms. Swart, thank you very much. We have our guest here. We've got Mr. Mazda Silwani here with us to go through the process of the interview. And as we pay attention and know that we will go through a CV. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, sir.
We want you to start off by just talking to your CV. You were nominated and you accepted the nomination, nominated by the Field of Expression. Your CV quite impressive. Out of the 143 nominations that we had, we were one of those who were shortlisted. Now you must talk to us, tell us about yourself, and maybe just do it today. You know, convince us, just tell those connectors you are the best person for the job. In other words, the 12 that we're going to appoint, you must be among the 12. You might just win it now or you win it later, I don't know. It's your call. Over to you, Mr. Floss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity afforded me to be interviewed. My CV, I don't really know where to start, but I'm going to leave out the academic stuff and all those sort of things, but I have worked for the Human Sciences Research Council as a research specialist, and the area on which I worked mostly was human rights studies. So I would like to say that one of the things I would be bringing to the party, if I were allowed, would be that understanding of human rights studies. You will also have picked up from my CV that I was a member of the Executive Committee of the Freedom of Expression Institute, and that I am the chairperson of the Media Institute of Southern Africa Trust Fund Board. Now, both organizations work extensively with freedom of expression issues. It is my view, Mr. Chair, that freedom of expression would be one of the central issues that one would have to deal with in the board, but it is one of the rights that contests the right of way with numerous other rights, and therefore one has to balance things out very carefully. I believe that I have both the theoretical and the practical framework within which to help in that very delicate balancing of rights. I have been a researcher, as I've indicated, with the Human Sciences Research Council, and I believe that I have picked up valuable skills in that area. It is something that I believe the board might benefit from if I were given the opportunity. I would like to think with all humility that I have more than an average skill portfolio in the area of labor relations, and it is my view that if I were given the opportunity, the board would benefit from that skill portfolio.
So, thank you very much. I see that you were born on at the end of many years ago, you know, just one day before the end of 1951. Where were you in 1952? I'm just trying to check the province here because I don't know whether you are accounting or...
Well, I think we would have to engage Home Affairs a little bit on when exactly I was born. The correct date of my birth is the 29th of August. It is actually my birthday today.
Oh, no!
But for reasons best known to themselves, they allocated me to the 31st of December, 1951. I was born in a little village in the Eastern Cape called Sterkspruit, Heschel. That's where I would have been in 1952.
No, thank you, sir. The question came out of a bit of research, you see. I'm just teasing. No, that's fine. I've seen Mr. Mashaloha. Do I see any hands in this mark?
Thanks, sir. Sorry, Chair. Mr. Sulwanikin, what's your conceptualization of what in the media and public discourse is referred to as public interest? And having done so, what's the interplay between that and the right of individuals to privacy? Perhaps as you respond to the question, you may make reference to the issues of freedom of expression, which include the rights of the media and so on, and vis-a-vis the right of individuals to privacy and dignity.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding of the public interest is something, it's going to sound a little bit tautological, but it's something that is in the interest of the public. Now, in the context of the issues that we are speaking about here today, I would assume what we would be speaking about is the interest of the public to know. Now, the interplay between the public's right to know what is happening, and this specifically refers to the largely to the realm of politics. It has, of course, as I have already implied, to be mediated by other considerations, and one of the considerations you're speaking about is the individual right to privacy. Now, my view is that it's not only freedom of expression that contests the right of way with other rights, but indeed all human rights that we have contest the right of way at one point or another, because whenever they intersect, you then have to decide which right takes precedence. Now, it is not my view that one can make, if you like, an a priori commitment and say whenever the right to freedom of expression clashes with the right to privacy, this is how I'm going to resolve the clash of those rights. We do not have in South Africa a hierarchy of rights which tells us that under these circumstances, these rights would take priority over these. It will always be a practical question. And the only thing that I would be willing to make an a priori statement on is where you are dealing with public figures. Where you are dealing with public figures, my view would be that by allowing themselves to hold the positions that they hold, they must have understood from the beginning that one of the risks that they would be taking is that their right to privacy would be limited by virtue of the decision that they have taken in the first place to hold certain positions. So, for instance, in my respectful opinion, an individual person in the street's right to privacy should be protected more than the right to privacy of a member of parliament, precisely because I think members of parliament owe the public accountability in promoting which it may become necessary to peer more into their private affairs than it would be necessary to peer into the private affairs of individuals. Now, the right to dignity that you are speaking about is considered in many instances to be the overarching right. In fact, I would say that it is the one right that underlies and is informed by all the other rights that we have. I would not ordinarily see an automatic clash between the right to dignity and the right to freedom of speech, because in my view, the right to dignity already implies the right to free speech. I feel that my dignity is terribly impaired if I were to wake up one morning and find that I am not allowed to express myself anymore. But at the same time, one has to maintain, as I say, a delicate balance, because you should not use your freedom of expression in order to unduly impugn the dignity of other people. But again, that would always, for me, be a practical rather than an abstract question. I would have to look at the facts of each and every case in order to decide what should prevail in these sort of circumstances.
Thank you, Mr. Swanus. Is there a take-off you must indicate?
Silwane, I've often over the years listened to, I think almost always on the subject of free speech, and just with great pleasure, here in Parliament, in various committees and so forth. One of the criteria we have to look for is a commitment to free speech and fairness and accountability on the part of those who hold public office. And I think your life and your CV are they prove the track record. The track record is there. And you're not only a founder member of the old FXI. I sometimes wonder about the FXI nowadays, but you're a founder member of the old FXI and of the Independent Media Diversity Trust, and currently on the MISA, and currently on the Institute for the Advancement, all the places where South Africans work in the interests of good media and free speech. So I recognize your track record. I'm curious about one or two things here that I thought I'd like to ask you about. The first one is just a little one, a bit frivolous, but what does a campus director do? I'm too interested to see you. You're in Tshwane. What does a campus director do? But now, just I see that you did something which interests me greatly. You were a member of the technical team evaluating the first term of the South African Human Rights Commission in 2001. And I would very dearly like to hear about the team and what your findings were. And you can probably guess why I'm so interested. It relates directly to the matter that you just dealt with, the balancing of rights. Would you like to give me a view, because I don't think I've ever heard you on the subject, of the Human Rights Commission under Dr. Pityana and its so-called media racism inquiry. And I would simply ask your view and whether that forms part of the work of the technical team. But implicit, you will realize that implicit in the question was the assumption that Dr. Pityana made that free speech and equality were two separate things and not two mutually reinforcing things. And his approach, you may remember, was to make equality in the guise of alleged subliminal racism, to make that supersede free speech. I will stop myself from giving my views, which were very strong, I'm interested to hear what your views were on that inquiry. And let's add, after that inquiry, what effect has it had? And also just whether the technical team looked at that in particular.
Thank you. That is all.
Thank you, Chair. Now, thank you, ma'am. The campus director, I didn't always know myself what the campus director does. But when I was appointed to that position, because my initial appointment to the university was as Director Promotion of Access to Information and Planning, I only got appointed as Campus Director after the merger of the three technicals, which then formed Tshwane University of Technology. But we have joked about it back at university. We've always said that the most important job of the campus director is to keep students happy, which isn't exactly an easy task. But really, it was a management position. The campus director would have run the campus. I have been running from 2004, 1st January 2004, the Harangua campus of the Tshwane University of Technology. In other places, for instance, in the Eastern Cape, they would have called it campus principal. Those would more or less be the responsibilities of the campus director. The technical team investigating the Human Rights Commission, I was indeed a member of that team, but it never really finished its task, because in the middle of our evaluation, there were very serious differences between the team and the management of the Human Rights Commission, as a result of which we had to fold up, so the task was never completed. Now, the Human Rights Commission's investigation of racism in the media, you indicate that you've never heard my views on the matter. It's actually very interesting, because I actually wrote an article for AIDS magazine in Cape Town here. In which I expressed my views on that investigation. And the central argument that I was making was that one should distinguish between propagating racism on the one hand and reporting on racism on the other hand. And that if the Human Rights Commission was saying that the media is propagating and encouraging racism, then my view would be that the investigation would be justified. But if the commission was concerned with the media reporting on incidents of racism, then that would be a completely different ball game, I argued at the time. Now, the other principal argument that I thought I was making in that piece was that in the long run, it is better to allow racism to surface rather than to suppress it. And what informed my analysis was that I was in East Germany at the time when the Berlin Wall was falling down. And one of the things that scared the daylight out of me was the xenophobia that was suppressed all along in East Berlin, but surfaced once the Berlin Wall started breaking down. And the conclusion that I drew for myself, and I thought South Africa might learn from that, is that it is better to allow racism to surface so that we can deal with it rather than suppress it, and then it expresses itself in ways that we did not anticipate, because by suppressing it, we are also denying ourselves the opportunity of learning how to deal with it. Those were my views.
I will resist the temptation of asking you about the beauty of the GDR during your time. I won't go there. Mr. Nxumalo and Mr. Khumalo.
Thank you, Chairperson. As we are interviewing SABC board, I'll be more technical than going the previous questions. Nowadays, the government is talking of digital, switching to digital, which will be higher resolution television and all the future generation stuff. These are the areas where people are not able to watch this television. If they do, they still use those old black and white battery operated. People who are marginalized and poor in the rural areas. How will you, if appointed in the board, be balancing the future generation ICT vis-a-vis the poor who have not even started?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Well, my view would be that one must go back to the ABCs and ask the question, why was it necessary to have SABC in the first place? Now, as I have understood the matter, we have needed SABC so that it will play, among other things, the role of informing the public. Now, everything that gets done, it seems to me, must be underpinned, among others, by that consideration. So, if we introduce new technologies, my respectful view would be that we have at all times to bear in mind that the primary aim, among others, is to inform the people. So I would not oppose the digitalization of television, but I would argue that there have to be parallel processes taking into account the realities of South Africa. The position as it exists presently is that we do have people living in the rural areas that you are speaking about who watch battery-operated televisions. So I would argue that rather than destroy immediately what we have presently in the interest of technological advancement, let's maintain what we have presently and build alongside it the technologically advanced stuff that we are speaking about, and only start removing what we are having today once we are certain that we would not be negating the right of people in rural areas to be informed in terms of what I understand to be one of the primary mandates of the SABC.
I hear what you're saying, but how are you going to ensure that the people in Herschel also get the benefit of the advanced technology that we're using on television, radio, and others, so that we don't just, the advancement of technology does not just benefit those who are currently covered, but those who are actually marginalized. I think that is the crux of the question as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, what I've tried to suggest is that I don't believe in technology for the sake of technology. I think that technology is an aid in order to enable us to live better. Now, technology might be advanced, but technology might also be primitive. The fact that some technology is primitive does not detract from its essential nature, that it is still technology. Now, I am cognizant of the fact that it costs a lot of money to bring about technological advancement. I would not imagine that one can, in one stroke, bring about technological advancement to all the areas of South Africa. I would imagine that it would have to be a process, but an irreversible process. I would imagine that there's a need to bring television to the areas where we don't have television. If what you are saying is that there is no television in Herschel as we are speaking, then I would beg to say no, in fact there is. But what they might not be able to cope with presently is digitalized television, and to introduce that, I think one would have to go in stages. It would be impossible in one stroke to introduce that through the lens and breadth of South Africa. But my argument would be that let's try and maintain the two systems parallel until such time that we are able to digitalize even Herschel.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kumar.
It's not double elimination, it's dual elimination. Yeah. It's a difference. Double it means on top of each other, dual it means set at the same time. Synchronous system, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm sorry you are touching a very subject matter, very close to my heart. I'm sorry, you just leave that to me. Sir, let's concentrate on the...
You did very well, Mr. Kumar. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Sulan. Mr. Sulan, the MISA annual report of 2005-2006, which also was tabled at the workshop in Zambia, organized by Frederich Herbert Stichstein, which I attended. They actually indicated part of the problems in South Africa in relation to broadcasting as well. There was a lot of political interference. They mentioned a number of ministers who were able to inform an MD of news or just some board members to say, I want publicity, this and that and that. But when we wanted that to be tested or to be put on the table, they could not really provide names. Of course, the allegations were that by then the Minister of Health was one of those who managed to do that. The second issue that was raised in the annual report of MISA was the fact that, apart from the fact that there was political interference, there was also a problem of editorial independence. The perception created by MISA report by then was the fact that, by the virtue of the broadcaster having so many ANC apparatchiks, as they call them in the report, is that it is likely that the news would be much more reflective of government successes and government ministers, and there's very little about corruption, crime, stuff like that, and all this type of thing. So therefore, the MISA report then concludes that South Africa is not far from many African countries in terms of dictatorship and this and that, which I thought it was a bit harsh, you know, comparatively speaking to the men, and now we have moved to many countries. Now my question to you is twofold. One, do you believe that there is political interference as far as the broadcasting corporation is concerned? If there is, what is that you might do or you would have to do to change that in an event that you are part of the board? Secondly, do you think there is a possibility that there could be interference editorially of the news and current affairs by any minister or any other person? Yeah, as we've been told by people there, that actually it's not fact that there could be such interference. I'm not so sure. So whether that has happened or not, but what would you do also to deal with a possible lack of editorial independence, and also in the context of MISA's whole mission and vision of a free press, freedom of expression, multiplicity of ideas, and you know, all those type of things. And then, so what is that could be your approach in terms of dealing with that? And then I could see here that you are from a background of power. You know, there was one tower that is a direct tower.
Yeah.
Tower was a director general of arts and culture. It says that his contract was not renewed recently, Professor Jumile Musana. There is very less coverage also in the context of a historical background of the Black Consciousness Movement and the Azania, stuff like that. There seems to be much more on the Africanist type of ideology and the nationalist. I'm not so sure whether do you think that I'm right, or and if not, you know, what could be done. And then the last point, the mandate of the broadcaster, it is to educate, to inform, and to entertain. How much of its budget must actually go to education instead of entertainment, and information. We are living in an information society. Actually, to understand that there is a presidential commission on ICT, information society and development, precisely to assist all of us to move. All of us here, as we are seated, one way or another, we are linked with cell phones, satellites, this and that. Now, that's not necessarily, that actually then changes. It puts a challenge to the broadcaster to say whether can it still be a beacon for information dissemination. You know, when this can then be done with all forms of platforms, it's not necessarily it being the most secure of news and stuff like that. So what should be done? Do you still believe that there should be, so much of the budget must go to entertainment, education, or to inform? Now that then links to the last question that relates to funding. The broadcaster's current funding model is this way. 80% is from advertising. 17% of that is from licensing. And 3% is from the state. Now, what type of funding model do you think would be perfect for the public broadcaster, as encapsulated in all the MISA reports that have gone through, in terms of what form of funding model can we have or should we have in South Africa? Thank you, sir.
Thank you. The question of political interference is one, I think, that will always bedevil the media, and especially
can I ask Mr. Yengeni not to disturb your questioner?
Yes.
Your questioner to pay attention?
Thanks.
Thank you. No, they were just excited about the issues of the tower.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I was saying that the question of political interference is one, I think, that will bedevil the media for a long time to come, especially in the situation of the SABC. Now, if I am asked whether, as a matter of fact, there is political interference in the SABC, I would say that I don't really know. But if I am asked whether I think there is, then my answer would be in the affirmative. Now, I would, however, not be able to pinpoint the so-called culprit ministers, possibly in the same way that you have indicated that NISA was not able to name them, but I would not be able to name them. But I would argue that there are indications which suggest that there may well be political interference. In fact, I am pleased that I did not have to raise the question of my political history. You raised it. But one of the things that troubled me considerably a few years back, and this was shortly after the 1994 election, was an interview that I saw with which was conducted by Phil, I'm trying to remember Phil's surname now, Phil Mulisen, and he was interviewing the then Deputy President Jacob Zuma. Now the interview was around June 16, and it was very clear from the setting that the interview was managed carefully in order to produce certain results. But what worried me was the fact that people were not even waiting for some of us who were involved in the Black Consciousness Movement in 1976 to die before rewriting the history of 1976. That worried me terribly, and I really didn't think that that is the role that the SABC should be allowing itself to play. So I think that the it would be possible to mention other examples. I mean, there are many question marks about the documentary that was spiked, but this wasn't the first time in the history of the SABC that a documentary got a spike. I might not be able to remember other concrete examples, but certainly this one involving the president was not the first one that was spiked. So it does seem to me that there might be political interference indeed. The question of editorial independence is one that is close to the hearts of many people who are involved with the media. I support the notion of editorial independence, but I do think that media practitioners themselves have to confer amongst themselves as to what editorial independence means, because there have been times when I was concerned that editorial independence is used as an excuse for doing things that they should otherwise not be doing. So if I were, for instance, given the opportunity to serve on the SABC board, that is one of the questions that I would like to bring to the center stage in terms of what does the SABC understand for itself to be the meaning of editorial independence, because I would be opposed to a system where people do a lot of things that they shouldn't be doing and they claim editorial independence. Perhaps I must give you an example. There was an article shortly after the 1994 elections written by Sandile Memela. He basically argued that any reference to blackness after the 1994 elections was no longer appropriate because we had ushered in a democratic order and we should now stop seeing people as black and white. Now, this was shortly after the 1994 elections. In my view, he was being unrealistic. I then wrote a response, but I had an agreement with the City Press that I would write the response on condition that they would publish it as a response and not as a letter which they could mutilate. They agreed that they would publish it as a response, but as soon as they received it, I actually heard them because I phoned them to tell them I have sent the piece now. I actually heard them calling Claudine down the corridor saying, aha, Amanda has responded. Now, they did exactly what they had promised that they wouldn't do. They mutilated my article, and after mutilating it, they really made me look very ridiculous. And then Sandile wrote a piece underneath which effectively said, with a man who reasons like this, what would you expect? Now, in my view, that is an abuse of editorial independence, and that is not what it should be meaning. I think that editorial independence should still be covered with responsibility. The question about my political history, yes, indeed, I was a member of the South African Students' Organization, I was a member of the Black People's Convention, I was a member of the Azanian People's Organization. The question about whether this political tendency is adequately reported on, I would like to fall back on Z.K. Matthews and what he wrote, and what we learned from him was that preferably we should approach these things without any bias and try and approach them as objectively as we possibly can. But he then continued and said, if it is, however, impossible to approach them without any bias, then what we must insist on is that all the biases must be stated, and that would be my position if I were given an opportunity to serve on the SABC board. Preferably, I would prefer that things should be approached without any bias, but if it is inevitable that people would be biased, then I would insist that all the biases must be represented. Now, the mandate of the SABC and splitting its budget, that's a very difficult question for me as an outsider in terms of how I would split the budget, but my instincts are like this. I come from an education and academic sort of background, and from where I am coming, methods that are educative would in all probability take precedence, but I would like to think that the way the SABC board makes its decisions around these issues is that they debate them and they take informed decisions. I would get in if I were given an opportunity with the attitude that a bigger part of the SABC budget must go towards educational programs. But I would listen to the views of the other board members and allow myself to be persuaded if they had a compelling argument to make in another direction. One of the reasons I would come out heavily in support of educational programs, without necessarily compromising the other programs, is that I think we have missed an opportunity in South Africa to make education accessible to everybody. I think we have missed that opportunity badly, and every space that we have in which we can educate people, I think we should try and promote it as forcefully as we possibly can. The funding model, a number of years ago when I was in the executive of the Freedom of Expression Institute, we actually made proposals around this, and what we were saying was we have learned from history that if you leave everything to the market, you might not realize some of the mandate that you have been called into existence in order to answer. I mean, those of us whose memory goes back to the days of the Rand Daily Mail might remember that the Rand Daily Mail was shut down basically because the advertisers were not happy with the line that the Rand Daily Mail was taking. And I think that to make the SABC 80% dependent on advertisers might not be the best thing that we should do. Now, I would therefore argue that the state has to pump in more money into the SABC. There are complications that would get created by that because often people take the view that who controls the purse calls the tune. Now, my view on these things and my position has been for a long while that firstly, I distinguish between the state and the government. When I speak about the state, I think we should resist any notion of thinking about government. But in the same way that the courts of the land are funded by the state and yet they are able to give decisions against the state, I think that the SABC must enjoy that sort of independence from the state. The fact that it would be funded more substantially by the state should not make it beholden to the state. It should still be able to have editorial independence once analyzed and agreed in terms of what the content of that editorial independence is. And that is a decision the SABC would have to make itself. It shouldn't come from the government, in my book. That would be my response to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Peter.
Jefferson, thanks. So I've noticed that you're also a labor relations consultant. Very often, the only problems, the only kind that we see labor relations matters, particularly around the workers. It's only when they strike, the trucks and fights, and all of that, and they've been shown as people that is unappreciative, destructive, and just all of us. Do you think that we need a better balance, that we should talk about labor in its true sense of what it does, what it offers us, all of us, and very often strikes us as an outcome of a process. I think it's a fair reflection of business. Regularly reported, labor basically has no voice, whether it's television or radio, like no voice at all. Other than workers on Wednesday, that I think this is the Metro, SAFM, some of the radio stations would do that, and particularly community radios. But in terms of your public broadcasters, there's hardly anything. And then within that labor, you find the dominant force is your black people, your ordinary worker, and that's all about. Do you think that we should have a better balance, more of that, other than and away from strikes, away from disputes, of the real essence that labor brings to the country?
Yes, I think it should be part of the educative process because labor is an important component of our social ordering, and I think that people should know about that. I would imagine a number of newspapers would, for instance, have a labor desk, that sort of thing. I would begin to speak about the possibility of having a labor desk on SABC so that we have regular comments. But that point made, I think that one should also think these things through very carefully, because if we do that, where do we stop? How long will it be before other stakeholders say we need a voice, before business says we need a voice, before all the other stakeholders in society say we need a voice? So I think, yes, it's unfortunate if labor is so underreported. I think there should be something more about it, but I think that one should think the whole matter out very carefully in terms of what it would mean in total terms.
How about keeping them out as long as you kept labor out?
Thank you, sir. Now, as a labor consultant, are you doing any work for the SABC, for instance, at the moment?
No, I'm not.
Okay. And just a count, I'm trying to check the board that you currently active on. If you can just give me an indication of how many. No, just write it down. I'm coming. This is just some closing shots because you have to say your closing remarks as well. I think we did sufficiently say happy birthday, and that if we knew that the Home Affairs made a mistake, we could have organized a cake. Now we believed what we saw on the CV. We didn't know that they actually made this mistake. In your column, in the Herald newspaper, in the Eastern Cape, you titled your column "No Holy Cows." What did you have in mind? And secondly, having seen the walls falling and things like those, is it true that the communists actually introduced the electronic media and that was used during the war and things like those? I'm just trying to check my facts here and also trying to just tell Mr. Swart something, give him a message. In 1987, I don't know why, did you abandon political ship or you did something else? Or you went underground? And lastly, I see that you've done a lot of work in Belgrade, for instance. You might have been one of my tutors there, country member. But it seems that is it still operative? What's happening at Belgrade at the moment?
Okay, thanks. There's only one board that I serve on presently, and it is the Media Institute of Southern Africa Trust Fund Board. Holy cows, what did I have in mind? when I started writing the column, I started writing the column, by the way, not for the Herald. It's getting published now in the Herald, but I started writing it for the then Evening Post, which then got closed down, and the Herald took the column over. But what was worrying me tremendously was the levels of political correctness that we were beginning to witness in South Africa and what they were doing to the country. I was worried that everybody was trying to be so polite and not asking the questions that we should be asking about society and not offering the criticism that we should be offering. And that's really what I had in mind, that in order to retain our sense of direction, one needed a little bit of irreverence. And so in that column, I try as best I can to bring just about anything under the sun, under the microscope, hopefully without fear or favor. I don't know whether communists introduced electronic mail or not. I genuinely don't know. Sorry. 1987. Do you want a diplomatic answer or a truthful answer? Well,
it's okay. Let's leave it for lunch.
Okay.
Okay. You can talk to you about it during lunch.
Okay.
Very strange. Is it still operating?
To the best of my knowledge, it's still operating. Thanks.
No, I think I'm going to just give you a minute to give us your closing remarks, not from me. Right.
Well, thank you very much. Firstly, as I have already indicated, I would like to thank you from the depth of my heart for allowing me to be interviewed out of the 140 plus people that have been nominated for the board. I hope that in the responses to the questions that you have put to me, you might be able to see a role that I may play in the board. But if you do not, I will accept that very judiciously. I will accept the fact that you were able to identify better candidates. I think that's all I would like to say. Thank you very much.
If I was saying those last words, I would say no, I would accept judiciously, but please do your best. once more, happy birthday and thanks for coming here. You may join us for lunch. Members, lunch is outside the way it was yesterday. And we're coming.